All right, you've got it on KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and McKinleyville. Translator, K282AD Ferndale, and stream it on the web at khum.com. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. We're wrapping up week two with a two-hour panel discussion dealing with Indigenous rights and cultural appropriation. Let me introduce who is in the room. We've got Chris Peters, who we spoke to earlier this week, but he is here in the studio with us. He's the president of the Seventh Generation Fund, and we also have Ted Hernandez, who is the chairman and cultural director of the Wiat Nation. Good morning to all. And, of course, my wife, Amy,
Who
is my co-host this year. Indeed. Didn't mean to leave you out, sweetie.
Thank you. I want to acknowledge at the very beginning that we are on Wiat land, and we respect that, and we appreciate that we are here, and we honor that.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to have you guys here on our land, and you know, like I tell everybody, this is our beautiful backyard, and you know, what's not to love about it? You have all this beautiful scenery out here.
Yeah, we wake up every day and say, thank goodness we live here.
Absolutely. So this week, it has been a fantastic week. We've had some terrific conversations. Chris, again, thanks for talking to me on Tuesday. It was terrific. Michaela came in to talk about cultural appropriation and did so from a very personal standpoint. And yesterday we had Ryan Jackson, the Hoopaw Tribal Chair, in to talk about their strong support of Standing Rock. Let's start there. This is one of those things that has captured the nation. There's a lot of press that is a lot of attention that's being given. However, we should note that this is one incident that is getting a lot of notice. There's plenty of other things happening around the nation that aren't getting a lot of notice that are really also very important, and we talked about that a little bit yesterday with Ryan Jackson, but the Indigenous people of Humboldt County have been standing with the Sioux at Standing Rock, and a lot of other people have been joining in with the protest as well. How is this going thus far? Do you feel there's progress? Do you feel that there's progress being made, or is it just more of a lot of pushback?
And what are you hearing from the water defenders?
Well, just to kick it off, thank you again for allowing us to be a part of this program today. I think Standing Rock is a milestone in Indigenous history, you know, comparable to Wounded Knee and other major...
Let's hope it doesn't get that violent.
Yeah. Pardon?
Let's hope it does not get that violent.
Oh, yes. Well, it's definitely a milestone. You know, it's a marker in history where people are standing up and just saying enough is enough, and you appreciate that type of energy. I think the impacts of Standing Rock in the general public is largely been shut out by contemporary or corporate media, if you will, and you know, nowhere else in the world can you have as many people on the front lines being brutalized by National Guard and police officers, and it doesn't make the national press. That says a lot, you know, in terms of where Indigenous peoples are in the American psyche, you know, and I think the significant difference of Standing Rock, it's a defense of Mother Earth and defense of natural systems. I would anticipate more and more of that type of action that be happening in the not too distant future. I mean, the encroachment on the vital ecosystems of Mother Earth can't go on ignored by the general public.
Absolutely, and that is a huge problem, and there are a large amount of people who are in complete denial of what the extraction resources are doing to this planet, and doing it at a very, very rapid pace. I mean, it's the person who just got elected to President of the United States claims that this is a hoax. that climate change is a hoax created by the Chinese. So it's we've got a long way to go. There are a lot of people, of course, who are in complete support of that, but we do have a long way to go with regard to people all getting on board to protect the planet.
As long as we're talking about Standing Rock and the Water Defenders, I will say that this evening at the Mattol Community Center in Petrolia, there is a Standing with Standing Rock event from 7 until midnight with music, and it's a sliding scale for everybody beginning at $10 per person, and it's all ages. So that is one event that if you're in the Mattol area, or if you'd like to go out there, it's absolutely beautiful. It's a great opportunity to put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, I have to agree with Chris. No, Standing Rock, myself, I feel is not really getting that much press attention. Like, things are happening today. You know, with the primary election, you get more of that now in the press than you do Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. You know, I have some of our young teenagers that went up there, and, you know, they were amazed on what they saw. And they come back and said, it is a completely different world up there. And, you know, they're happy to be home because, you know, it's different. And how people are being treated up there, how, you know, the protectors are being treated, it's just completely different. And I think Chris said it best, is that we're here to, you know, water is life. That's what we're here to protect. And we all have our own battles up here for our own rivers and our own water. And that's what we're here to do, is that's protect it. Because, you know, like, if we keep messing with it, Mother Earth is going to get mad, and she's just going to make things happen for herself. And people are not seeing that. They're not understanding that. And it just doesn't affect the Native American community in Standing Rock. It affects that whole area. Everybody's going to get affected by that if those pipes break. And we know they will break because nothing lasts forever. And that's going to affect a lot of people's drinking water.
Absolutely. Why do you think that there's been such resistance to rerouting this to a less sensitive area?
I believe, you know, my theory is that it's the cheapest way, the cheapest route. Let's do it. I mean, because if they have to go the long way around, then that's going to cost the corporation more money. And, you know, corporations are about making money. They don't care about other people's welfare and other people's drinking water. It's like, this is the quickest route. This is the way we're going to do it. And that's how it's going to be done.
Yeah, it would be. There are so few. I mean, locally, we have a lot of companies who do have that triple bottom line. But nationally, I think we don't have very many.
And of course, this is, as we mentioned, this is kind of the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of this going on throughout the land, and not all of it getting the attention. And as you're saying, even though Standing Rock is getting attention, there's a lot going on there that we don't see.
Right.
That is pretty horrific. We've got to take a quick break, our first break here, and I also want to remind people that this is a community dialogue and that you are certainly welcome to join in, ask questions, make comments. The topic is Indigenous rights and cultural appropriation, and we'll kind of go throughout the morning in all aspects of that. And as I said, if you've got a question or a comment, please call 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. If you get a ring, just let it keep ringing until I have a chance to answer. All right, it's 13 minutes after 8. You've got it on KHUM. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. It's our panel discussion going on this morning, Indigenous rights and cultural appropriation and all things around that. Joining my wife, Amy Berkowitz, and myself in studio, we've got Chris Peters, president of Seventh Generation Fund, and, of course, Ted Hernandez, who's the chairman and cultural director of the Wiat Nation. So, again, we were discussing Standing Rock a little bit, but when we were off air, some interesting stuff came up, and we were talking a little bit about local history. And Amy, you want to leave that?
Sure. I think that in light of the comments by the president of HSU, when she said that we really don't have racism here, acting like that was a big surprise. In light of local history, in light of the experiences of Native people and people of color here, I think we do need to go into local history. And HSU, to their credit, has a very excellent Native American Studies program, has a social work program, or sociology program, excuse me, that is focused on decolonizing work. And I hope that the president takes some time to get to know these programs, because I think they're an asset to the community and hopefully to the world.
Yeah, and, you know, it's probably not only the president, but I would imagine a lot of the instructional staff at Humboldt State University is stuck at sort of an old paradigm, you know, and the old paradigm has been around conquest and domination, sort of coming out of a very strong forestry program and still maintains that, but and with the mascot of
a lumberjack,
you know. What message does that present to the world, you know? And that is sort of the perpetuation of conquest and domination. Let's cut the forest. Let's demolish things. Let's utilize Earth's elements for human consumption. And that's the message of the university and sort of the message of capitalism to a certain extent. And that's where we find ourselves today in the middle of a very significant society that's hell-bent on destroying the earth. And it definitely has some parallels to what's going on in Standing Rock and throughout the world.
Absolutely. And I know that you were mentioning the lumberjack at Humboldt State as their mascot. Now, that has been a controversy for some time, and there has been a push to change that thus far. It's pretty much fallen on deaf ears, but
and similarly with the loggers at Eureka High.
Absolutely.
I know that a few years ago, some of the students wanted to become the spotted owls, and that pretty much fell on deaf ears. But I thought that was a courageous, you know, effort, a beginning of a discussion, hopefully.
Right, but you know what you spoke of, Chris, with the extractive industries that we've had for the past 100 years have had such
2,000 years.
Right, but especially the last 100 years has been ramped up to such a degree. The impact on the planet has been significant. It has, it really can't be sustained.
And you have to remember also that the mainstream culture is largely informed by and formed by these old Victorian notions of man's quote unquote rightful place in domination of nature, and nature there to serve the needs of progress and of the dominant society. And we know that that's not true. But we still hold on to these values from the 1800s.
Oh, perhaps even earlier than the 1800s.
Sure.
You know, these are rooted in sort of the Western civilization concept. You know, as sort of the movement away from the concept that Earth is sacred. You know, certainly held by indigenous peoples through today, and the non-native community made a separation at some point in their history where after some 60,000 years of believing that the earth is sacred, you know, and that we're connected to a living earth. And they made the change, you know, at some point, maybe because of Abrahamic concepts in theology, saying that we have now some domination over Earth, the right to rape their mother, if you will. And that's sort of the sin, the terrible sin that plagues Western society is being able to rape their mother. And that has been perpetuated. To admit it is a disgrace. A terrible disgrace. So all they can do is deny it, and deny it to the point where they will destroy the earth.
And we were talking a bit of history, and the quote unquote lack of racism here in Humboldt County, which is unfortunately not true. And very unfortunately, Humboldt County itself has a terrible racist history. When colonization happened here in Humboldt County, it was very brutal. It was very violent, and we were talking. The peoples of Humboldt were a very, very peaceful people. This was a very harmonious part of the world before colonization, and everyone knows about what happened on Indian Island back in the 1800s, and that was a disgrace. But there was much more than that that happened here. That was, again, the big horrific thing that everyone took notice of. But it was going on for some time. And there's, unfortunately, a long history of that.
No, there is. I mean, you know, the massacre was one of the biggest things out here. But, you know, it wasn't just on Indian Island. We had the massacre on the Eel River. We had the massacre on the Mad River. We had these massacres. Individuals wanted the resources. They wanted to take what they can take. And, you know, the Wiats were peaceful people. We assisted people. We helped people. You know, people got lost. We showed them how to get home. And we weren't that violent. We were, you know, our purpose was to take care of Mother Earth. And that's all the tribes around here were to take care of Mother Earth. We have our ceremonies, which is healing the world. And we were practicing that night at Indian Island. And that's when they decided to come on and just take what they wanted to take. And, you know, most of our people died on that island. You know, the men luckily survived because they were out gathering and getting supplies for the next day. But our elders, our women, and our children were at these sites, and they had nobody there to protect them. And, you know, it's continuing today because people do not want to realize that Native Americans are here, and we're still going to be here. And our main purpose is to take care of what we're put here to do, and that's take care of Mother Earth. Because like Chris says, she's alive. You know, the water that runs through the ocean runs through her veins that keep her going and keep through our rivers going. But the more they do to the land and the rivers, it's destroying her. You know, we're having more earthquakes. We're having more severe weather conditions. She's warning us, saying, hey, you need to stop or else I'm going to take care of myself.
And getting back to the local history, we were talking also off air a little bit about local violence and what's happening with kids in our local schools.
Native American children, I mean, they get treated a lot different in school, you know, because people want to believe that, oh, they come from a reservation, so, you know, everything's bad on reservations. That's how people picture today. Reservations are bad. Well, not all reservations are bad. But they're picturing our kids come from, you know, addiction families and abusive families. So they figure it's okay to treat them that way while they're in school. You know, they feel like they're used to it. So what are the other kids going to do? They're going to bully them. They're going to treat them that way. And, you know, our kids do what they do. They defend themselves. And then they feel that our kids are being mean and aggressive. No, our kids are basically defending themselves because they want to stop the violence and they want to stop the bullying.
I was just seeing a report of in this post-election, which was an election that really brought out a lot of racism to the forefront, unfortunately. And one of the unfortunate aspects of this is that, maybe one of the eye-opening aspects as well, is the fact that racism has always existed in this country, and many people, especially of privilege, feel that it's been going down. But the reality is the racism has become more subtle, less overt. And during this last campaign, when there was so much open racism being spoken by a major party candidate, that it almost became okay to bring it back out in the open.
No, I agree with that part. And you know, it was just recently that, and I told my wife I wouldn't talk about it, but I have to talk about it today. You know, in my child's school, one of the staff members was there after the day of the election, was just chanting Trump, Trump, Trump. And, you know, at the school. At school. And there's a lot of Native American children there, Hispanic children there. And how do you think those children felt? You know, and I'm lucky that my child had the guts to go up to this person and say, why'd you vote for this individual? And the individual just walks away.
Was this a staff member?
This is a staff member. This is an adult that's yelling it in the school grounds while kids are in school. You know, kids are already scared of what's going to happen. You know, some kids are in the Hispanic community. Are my parents going to get deported? Or, you know, why is this individual doing it? But luckily I have my wife is very strong and she took care of it and it stopped. But
she shouldn't have had to, because we are, those of us who are educators, are always admonished to keep our personal opinions to ourselves, whether we teach at the university, the college, or at an elementary school. And I find it disturbing that someone felt like they had the privilege to be able to put their opinions out there to children.
But like, you know, what I said earlier is that it's opened up now, so that when this candidate went out and did it, people feel that, oh, it's okay now, I can do it and I won't get in trouble. And, you know, and that's wrong. You will get in trouble, and you it's I went to a Boys and Girls Club, and it's so interesting how much these young children know about history, and they want the history out there, and they want the truth out there, but they're not being taught that in school because people are afraid to open the wounds of racism, of what happened in the island, or what happened in this area, not just in Wiat country, but in Yurok country and in Hoopoe country. It happens everywhere. And it's coming from a seventh grader that said, why don't we get the truth out there? And I said, well, that's your job. You know, tell your teachers you want it. Tell them you want to bring it in and tell them. Because you have a lot of people that will come in and teach you guys this. And we will assist you guys this. But they, you know, they're pushing it forward now. It's our young generation that's pushing this forward.
So, Ted, for people who are listening who would like that history to be brought to their school or their organization, how do they get in touch with you to get that help?
What they can do is they can contact the tribe, and they can contact me or the, you know, and I had to make a correction, the cultural director, Tom Tormer there.
Yeah, and he's the assistant cultural director.
And we would set up a program where we can go into the schools. We do, you know, we do take stuff to the classes. We do talk to the classes about it. We just have to have the schools call us, and we'll make an effort to get there.
Thank you so much. I mean, I was so gratified when I, you know, sent the first email saying, would you like to be part of this discussion? And the response was so fast and so positive. And I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that I could, as a person who's white, say, could you come and help us? And you were like, yes, absolutely, we're there. I'm very grateful for it.
Well, I think that's, you know, we all want to get the news out there. You know, I am surrounded by a lot of, you know, I don't know all about my stuff, but I'm surrounded by a lot of great mentors that is teaching me as well. And that's what these youth need. They need mentors to be teaching them. I will say Chris Mint is one of my mentors. You know, he's taught me a lot, especially my son. He's taught my son a lot, which I couldn't have taught him. So, you know, I have to thank Chris for that.
Now, one thing that you talked about is some of the history, the genocide that's not being taught, and this is one of those issues that happens a lot in history when there is something that horrific and ugly. People don't want to talk about it. They kind of want to just like, well, that happened in the past. We don't want to talk about that. We don't want to talk to our children about that because we don't want to scare them. But the reality is, they should be scared.
Mm-hmm.
This did happen, and this didn't happen that long ago. And to be honest, the attitudes still linger there. You know, we need to know that that we are capable of this, and it needs to always be brought up. The history does need to be taught.
It does need to be taught. I mean, you know, I'll go back to saying what I said in the past is that the indigenous community here in the United States was one of the worst genocides ever. But yet, we don't want to talk about it, but we want to sweep it under the rug. But when that happens in World War II, Nazi Germany, with the encampments there, we'll talk about it. But we don't want people to know, hey, we did it ourselves, and we don't want the younger generation to know about it. But I got news. The younger generation already knows about it because they're hearing it, and younger generations are talking to each other about it. And we can't sweep it under the rug no more. It has to be told, because that's the only way things are going to be start the healing process. It has to be told.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, the genocide that took place in World War II is talked about a lot because that was, especially in this country, that was them. That was them. And you know, we don't like to talk about the fact that we can be so genocidal as well. But we have that history as well, and we need to own it.
We do. I mean, there's parts in history in where I say that, you know, where Hitler learned more about genocide, what he learned about the Native American community and the cowboy and Indian days. That's where he learned. Well, this is why they did it, so it's okay for me to do it. But you know, we as a country, we went over there and we fought for them. But like I said, is that we don't want everybody to know that we did it. So we're gonna go sweep it under the rug and say we saved this culture, but we demolished the other culture.
While we were interring Japanese Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. You know, I think we even the topic of that we're addressing this morning is sort of a very typical situation that we have to look at, is that this should already be in the curriculum. I mean, it's something that is a true history of the United States. It, we shouldn't have to be calling the tribe and asking for input. Their generosity to come out and teach this should be already in the curriculum at the colleges and universities.
And at the high schools.
Definitely.
You know, our 16-year-old is taking world history. And it's very white, it's very European. And he came home after the first day and said, this is a bunch of you-know-what, because we're not looking at the rest of the world very much. We're certainly not looking at the local genocides. That he goes, history is written by the victors, and we are definitely getting that party line. Yeah. And he was really upset. And I don't blame him. I don't blame him. But, you know, he's a skinny little 10th grader talking to this teacher who says, oh, no, this is what I'm teaching. This is the curriculum.
Yeah. But in terms of the preparation of teachers themselves, they should come out of the colleges, the college systems, knowing this information, mm-hmm. and being willing to apply it in their instructional programs. That should already be there. You know, indigenous peoples all over the world, but particularly local, we're the conscience of America. You know, as long as we're around, we're a continuing reminder of this genocide that you talk about. We're a continuing reminder that how they're living a life and the impacts on the Earth's ecosystems is wrong. And as long as we're there saying we are world renewal people and continuing ceremonies, that becomes less and less accepted. You know, the elections of Donald Trump as president, you know, I think it's an unveiling of America. And to that, I think we give him a little bit of credit, because, you know, not to address this issue is wrong. You know, to be able to unveil America's racism so that it can be addressed effectively, and whether it's in the streets, as of last night in Eureka and Arcata and San Francisco, Berkeley, and all over the major cities, you know, it's already surfacing that we have to address the situation. You know, Donald Trump is sort of the spokesperson for it, but it's the majority of America.
That is the case. I mean, you take a look at the fact that half the population of this country said, I'm with this guy. And that was a big reveal when, and in that case, as ugly as it is, as a gut check as it is for any of us who were not in his camp, it is almost a favor, as you said, that where it has revealed, it has pulled, the cloak has been pulled away, the rug has been lifted, and we get a chance to see what's there. And I think a lot of us are shocked, and I think that's where the outrage is coming. That's where there's the protests in the streets. But it is almost a gift to those who feel we can do so much better, to know there's a long way to go.
There's a long way to go, man. You know, and Donald Trump is a part of this, you know, but there's going to be a lot of healing that needs to take place. And in order for this country to work the way people want it to work, is everybody needs to work together, you know, and the history needs to get out there. It needs to get out there, you know. They like to hide things, you know, and we're here to stop the violence, you know, because we forget about our women that are also being violent. And, you know, that's not being talked about, you know, and the indigenous women that are being taken from their families still, and mm-hmm. nobody knows where they're at. It's still not being talked about. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's happening in indigenous country, but it doesn't being talked about because nobody wants to know about it, because they want to know that this is a country that doesn't do that stuff. But it still happens today.
Yeah, and Canada's just coming to grips with that. Mm-hmm. They're just now starting to talk about it. We're not even talking about it yet.
No, we're not.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit more about that, Ted, because you brought something up that definitely needs to be looked at. But I got to keep us on track, so we're going to let our sponsors say a few words, and we'll continue on this dialogue here on our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And a reminder that you are certainly welcome to be part of the conversation at 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. All right, it is 37 minutes after 8 o'clock. You're listening to KHUM, and normally at this time it's our Friday Funnies, but we're in the middle of the Stop the Violence campaign, so today we have got a panel discussion dealing with Indigenous rights and cultural appropriation. Let me introduce everyone in the room again. My wife, Amy Berkowitz, my co-host today. We also have in the studio Chris Peters, president of Seventh Generation Fund, and Ted Hernandez, chairman and assistant cultural director of the Wiat Nation. Got that correct now.
So as we've been talking about the responsibility that you all take for being the spokespeople to keep Mother Earth safe and healthy, and the work that water protectors are doing at Standing Rock, my question is, what can those of us who would like to support your work do to be helpful?
What I've just learned about is that when people call me, I'm sending them to the True North organization. They're the ones that are doing a lot of work out here, sending people to Standing Rock. So I send them to their website, and I direct them to them. You know, the tribe, the Wiat tribe, has already sent a resolution supporting Standing Rock, but we are really not really economically sufficient to send our people there. But so we send support and prayers to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when our youth make it there, like our young lady, Pilar James, who went there last month, you know, we're honored to have her there. And then we have another young man that's just returning from Standing Rock, and his name's Mike Pillier. He's returning from Standing Rock. And, you know, for them to tell stories to the younger generation when they get back is interesting. But I tell people to just send to True North organization, because those are the ones that are doing most of the sending right now.
And one thing to note also is that you know, anyone who wants to take part in this, please do so for the right reasons.
Exactly.
I mean, there are people who just want to take place in a protest just because they want to, you know, be part of something like this. Understand what you are getting into, and understand why you are doing this. You know, be part of, you know, why this protest is happening. Don't just be part of a mob. You know, understand what this is really all about.
Yeah, and I think, you know, water is life is a significant slogan, but the primary purpose as we see is the continued fossil fuel industry. You know, for years we've advocated strongly that 350 campaigns to be able to keep the CO2 pollutants down below 350 milligrams per
parts per million.
Parts per million, yeah. We just exceeded 400, and you know the impacts of that figure is that it's only going to grow higher, and we have reached a point where there's going to be some significant impacts on the climate.
Absolutely. You know, well, it's already showing.
I mean, definitely.
And you know, there is you know, most scientists agree that there is a tipping point where it may not be able to come back.
Recover. And yeah. When you say most scientists, you're talking about 98% of,
right,
of recognized climate. And that's a huge number.
That's
a huge number. And the other thing that just came out in the news this week is that the only reason why it's not even higher than it is because of the green things. So if you're planting trees, if you're planting things in the ground, you're actually helping. And that is making a bigger difference than they thought it would.
Definitely so. You know, I think the more significant impacts, and rather than jumping your fossil burning fuel car and driving to Standing Rock, you may be doing some more impacts on the Earth's ecosystem than you're doing any good getting to Standing Rock.
Absolutely.
You know, so that you know, looking at your own consumption.
But the thing we all want, you know, the nation to do a better job to push for cleaner energy creation, but there are things that every individual can do, and every individual adds up to a mighty force. You know, there's all things that we can do to do a better job. We can use more energy efficient lighting. We can get a solar system for our house. We can get energy efficient vehicles.
But you know, those are expensive things.
They are.
Less expensive things that make a difference. Cloth reusable bags.
Yeah.
Planting trees. Carpooling. Walking and riding a bike when you can. Putting your trips together so that you're driving less. Being mindful of those things. And, you know, using less, reducing more, recycling more. All of that helps.
All of it helps, and definitely. But sometimes you look at that activity. We're straightening the deck chairs on the mm-hmm. Titanic.
Yeah.
You know, those are things that we feel a level of guilt for our impacts, and we're doing some minor things. You know, what we need is a major paradigm shift in the world, you know, and you know, indigenous concepts and indigenous knowledge, you know, has been looked at for years as showing a path for this social transformation in the world that is so desperately needed now. How do we change people's thinking away from that conquest and domination mentality that's pervasive here in Humboldt County to the point of denial? How do we begin to change that concept? You know, and at the same time, you know, the violence and racism that exists in the society is to be able to put that concepts down. It's not true. It's not happening. Indigenous peoples are not alive. In fact, the curriculum you're talking about in public schools is designed to acculturate us to be brown-skinned white folks. That's what it does. I mean, that's what public schools curriculum is set up to do. How to acculturate and change the thinking, the paradigm, if you will, of a people that believes that the earth is sacred to a point where we join American consumption. And that's a travesty.
As well said, and that is one of the huge tragedies is the oppression of a culture, and
it's not just oppression; it's an attempt at annihilation.
Annihilating a culture, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a cultural genocide, essentially, is what we're talking about, and there has been just incredible resilience with the indigenous peoples of this country to hold on to the shreds of the culture. It's it is terrible that to this day there is a an attempt to, as you said, you know, make brown-skinned white people.
Or black-skinned white people.
Or black-skinned
white people. Or yellow-skinned white people. Yeah. You know, that's the American system. And it's not only happening to people of color, it's happening to the normal Caucasian or white America as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's conforming our thinking to believe and act a certain way. And it's a system that impacts everybody in the same way. I mean, standardized curriculum that we here in Ferndale study the same thing on the same day as people in the inner cities of New York. You know, how ridiculous is that concept? You know, and that's what we are supporting, and that's what we're doing. You know, even under the more liberal Democratic administrations, that hasn't changed. You know, Standing Rock happens under Obama administration. And it would certainly have continued under Clinton administration. Yep. No change.
Well, that was one thing that was a really interesting thing yesterday when I was talking with Ryan Jackson, which is kind of an eye-opener to me, was, you know, my assumption is that, you know, more progressive Democratic administrations will do a better job with the Native American community. That is not necessarily so. As a matter of fact, he said probably the most progress was made during the Nixon administration, which was a surprise to me, to be quite honest. But
not only to Native peoples, but to the environment. I mean, Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, all of that happened under Nixon administration.
And it looks like we've got someone who wants to join in the conversation. So we will, if you can put on your headphones, and we'll take this call. Hello, you are on the air on KHUM.
Hi. My name's Smokey. Good
yes.
morning, Amy.
Hey, darling.
Hi. I have, unfortunately, you know, I have to work. So I've missed most of this week, which I've been very sad about. But I was wondering if in previous conversations this week, if anyone has talked about Donald Trump's policy about we're all Americans and he wants to do away with sovereign nations. And what that would mean to the Native Americans of this country. I mean, that just opens the door to fracking, oil drilling, pipelines, the rest of, you know, denuding the rest of the forests, you know, offshore drilling off the coast of California. I mean, he wants to do away with everything. And for us, in my heart, being a Native American, that just, it scares me. Very much.
Those are very scary things.
Absolutely. And this is actually, we haven't really gone into depth on that. We talked a little bit about, you know, about the different administrations and their impacts on you know, the Native American community. But with regard to doing away with sovereign nation status, no, we have not talked about that.
And don't get me wrong. I don't think any of the administrations, Republican or Democrats, has mm-hmm. been significantly fantastic for indigenous peoples.
Right.
You know, the ultimate goal is acculturation, and that's the administration's primary purpose in establishing an Indian department. And
well, the fact that we even have a BIA right yeah. there says it all.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and it's established for acculturation. I mean, that hasn't changed since the Gold Rush times. You know, that hasn't changed since boarding schools. It's a continued systematic and sustained effort for acculturation and to do away with the Indians.
And I think, you know, one of the part is that where they say they want to terminate sovereign nations, it's going to be pretty hard. You know, me as a Native American man, you know, I'm not too worried about them what Trump says, because now that you see everybody standing at Standing Rock, you have over 100 nations standing together. You know, we're united. So it's going to be pretty hard for that administration to say we're terminating sovereignty. Well, it is. But they've done it before. I'm not saying it can't be done. They've done it before, but we as an indigenous people come together and we brought it back. You know, a lot of people don't realize that the indigenous people are in the Constitution. We are already recognized as nations. So, if they want to go that route, they can go that route. But I'm telling you right now, you know, our indigenous people are standing together, and we are not going to allow this to happen.
Well, I just remember, oh my God, the starving children. Well, I'm an older person, so I remember in the 60s when Bobby Kennedy was the first candidate ever to even go to the reservations and showed the starving, swollen bellies of the children and stuff, and he actually brought real national attention to our plight. And it just scares me that we may lose United Indian Health Clinic if they get. I mean, what it is the gentle stroke of the pen genocide. You know, because all they have to do is just draw a line through the tribal status, and the tribe disappears. And they've done that time and time again. So if they try and do away with sovereign status, it's like the ultimate broken treaty. And it's all for greed. It's all for greed. It really bothers me. And as a woman, and as a woman of color, and as a Native American, I'm very frightened.
No, I hear you on that part, because my oldest is actually feels the same way you do. You know, and I have to tell her that we will survive. We will come back. You know, we're not going nowhere. And they can do it with a stroke of a pen, but they forget. A lot of our younger generation are educated, and they're educated in law. So we do have that power as well. We can take it to the Supreme Court just as like they can do it. And that's why we tell our younger generation, go out and get educated so you can represent us and take care of us when this stuff happens. Because back when they did the termination, none of us were educated that well. But now we are, you know, a lot of our Native Americans are educated. And yeah, they're educated well.
I'm very proud of us. We're doctors and we're lawyers and we're nurses and we're, you know, we're educators and we're, you know, leaders of our tribe. And we're the ones that are keeping the light lit. And I just want to thank you guys so much for doing this panel this week. I'm so sorry that I missed most of it, but, you know, I work.
It's all up at KHUM.com if you want to check it at your convenience.
Oh, great.
On your computer.
Okay? Great. And I want to thank Amy and Cliff for doing this panel with Native Americans for this week because, wow, it's amazing. Thanks a lot, you guys.
We love you, Smokey.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Alrighty.
It's not really quite fair when my best friend calls, right?
friends and...
extended family.
Extended family. And, well, that really includes all of Humboldt County. We certainly invite anyone to call in and ask a question, make a comment. 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. That is the number. I'm going to take this opportunity to pause and take another quick break, and we will continue with this conversation here at KHUM. If you, as I said, if you want to join the conversation, this would probably be a good time to call. I'm always surprised how fast these conversations go. We're already past our first hour here on our two-hour panel discussion dealing with Indigenous rights and cultural appropriation. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign on KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and Ferndale, and stream it on the web at khum.com. And as I mentioned to Smokey, I'll mention this to everyone as well, all the conversations we've had thus far this week and we'll continue to have next week, you'll find posted up at khum.com. Just click on the Stop the Violence logo. It'll take you to the Stop the Violence page and also gives you a chance to scroll through previous years. It also has resource information as well on that page.
Yeah, that's an interactive resource list, and you can either look at all of the resources that are available, or you can go through our little questionnaire, which starts with questions like, would you like to help or do you need help? Mm-hmm. Because we have all kinds of resources there for domestic violence support, child abuse, etc. So we try to and sexual assault, we try to make, and animal abuse, we've tried to gather up as much as we can and put it in one place.
Absolutely. So I think it's time we went around the room and reintroduced ourselves. I am Cliff Berkowitz.
I'm Amy Berkowitz, mm-hmm. and I'm your co-host this year, filling in for Sherry Jackson.
Johnson.
Sorry, see, I'm all discombobulated. Mm-hmm. Sherry Johnson, who's been your co-host for the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Chris Peters. I'm with Seventh Generation Fund, and I'm Yurok and Kedrick Indian from the Klamath River.
And I'm Ted Hernandez, and I'm from the Wiat tribe.
Fantastic. Well, again, thank you all for taking the time to come in here and share. This has been a terrific conversation, and as I said, we've already burned through our first hour. It's incredible, as that may seem.
And, Cliff, I just wanted to follow up on that conversation and just mention the tenacity of Indigenous people's ability to survive. You know, as Ted says, we survived the worst Holocaust in the world. We've survived the gold rush. And certainly we can survive a Trump administration. You know, the will to survive is there. I think the principles of Indigenous survival is certainly our relationship to the earth and our adherence to ceremony. And if those things continue, they can do whatever they want to do, and we're going to continue to exist here.
Well said. Well said. Now, one thing, Ted, that you mentioned that we haven't explored yet, and it's one of those unfortunate things that is so unpleasant no one wants to talk about, and you mentioned about women being taken.
It's, you know, it's one of those things that people, like I said, don't want to talk about, but we do have to get the word out there, is that our Indigenous women are being taken in the States today. You know, there's slave trafficking, there's sex trafficking. Our women are being taken and nobody's hearing from them. But you don't hear that much about that because nobody wants to talk about it. Because why? They're just Native women. Well, they're somebody's mother, they're somebody's daughter, they're somebody's sister, and they're somebody's granddaughter. They need to be talked about. They need to be recognized. They need to be known that we are looking for you. We are searching for you. But when it comes to Native people, you know, people really, there's that racist part. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to see it. It's not our business. Well, it is your business, because if it was your mother, your daughter, your sister, you want the word out there as well. So I got to remember that it's happening. And, you know, they did it back in the early days, and when the boarding schools came, they took them. They took even young men. It's happening to everybody. But we have to keep the word out there saying that we are still looking for you, and we won't stop searching until we find them. And we will make sure that this stops. It has to stop.
And the numbers are much higher than anybody would want to wish.
No, they are high. They're very high. And, you know, and that's the sad part, is that the numbers are high, but you don't hear much about it. Because why? It's the Native American community again. Nobody wants to talk about it. We have to talk about it. We have to let them know.
And this is, again, one of the the subtle parts of racism that that we as a people don't like to look at, but it needs to be brought out there, is that when something happens to a community of color and we kind of turn a blind eye to that, if you were to take this same circumstance and say this is happening to the blonde-haired, blue-eyed community, there
especially
would be
an affluent
blonde-haired, blue-eyed community, there would be outrage, and there should just be outrage, period. And this is one of the things that, again, it's one of the things we kind of turn a blind eye to, but it's there.
At Seventh Generation Fund, we have a program called the Thriving Women's Initiative, and looking at these issues really specifically, in the United States, about eight out of 10 women are impacted. 80% of the indigenous women experience some type of physical or sexual assault, mostly perpetrated by non-indigenous peoples.
Can we just stop a second? Because
yes.
That number is so high. I want people to think about it. 80%. That's out of 10 women, 8.
Mm-hmm.
Go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then 2 are not, maybe. Those are 2 that haven't come forward, probably.
Yeah.
That is an intolerably high number.
It's an outrageous number, and you know, the attitude of American public toward indigenous women continue to be as negative, and as they're less than human, if you will, and toward indigenous men too, but particularly indigenous women. When, you know, here in Northern California, with the conquest, if you will, the taking of Wiat land, you know, up until the early 1900s, it was still legal to scalp Indians, you know. And most of the Indian women have, we call it a poi,
the 111
marks. Rather than taking a scalp, people can cut that off a woman and get cash for it. You know, and that's an atrocity, you know, an atrocity that was perpetrated by a lot of the ancestors here in Humboldt County, the massacres. You know, names of major families in Humboldt County still survive and still benefit off the atrocities that happened here. So that continues, you know, and, you know, the taking of land, the stolen land here goes on discussed. You know, like women, the perpetration of violence against earth is as significant. It is the same mentality as the perpetration of violence against women, Native women. And, you know, I don't know how we can get people to understand and grow beyond that, but the blatant disregard of Native women is so pervasive in American society.
And I guess what I, you know, say to this is that, like Chris mentioned, back in the early 18, when the massacres were happening, you know, our women were being taken, and they were being raped, and they were being put into slavery. And it still happens today. Because nobody, like I said earlier, nobody wants to talk about it. It's okay, because we did it back in the 1800s, so it's still okay to do it. And we're not going to get in trouble for it, because nobody really cares about the Indians. Well, that's wrong, because we do care. And as Native men, we will protect our women. We will defend our women. That's what our roles are to do. You know, with the help of a lot of organizations, we are making our voices heard that this is going to stop. You know, like Chris said, the number's high, but we're going to get the numbers down. You know, it may take a couple years, but we'll get the numbers down, and we're going to be there to defend our women.
And what organizations can people support if they want to be part of that work?
Well, I think they need to educate their sons primarily, and that's the biggest support they can provide to Indigenous or any women of color, but women in general. You know, the perpetration of violence against women in general is being done by American men, mm-hmm. and to educate their sons, raise them in a right way, can do more for this than anything, any kind of dollar contribution to anything. You know, a dollar contribution to something is sort of a, I made a contribution, you know, I've made a donation to save a dog, you know, mm-hmm. so I'm okay now. No, you're not okay. I mean, it's still pervasive within each of the families out there. And how do we address that is an important step that society needs to take.
And we have to acknowledge this is uncomfortable stuff, and people don't like uncomfortable stuff. But it's, you know, that's why we're taking this on. We're taking a week to deal with this rather than a few minutes, because I people need to hear it. And we're just in Humboldt County. We're a small little community, and but perhaps we can have, you know, some of an impact in our little corner of the world here. You know, if we can begin a dialogue in a family that was not wanting to talk about this, I think we've accomplished something this week, and that's really what we're trying to do.
And I like how Chris said the best. It starts in the home. You have to teach your son. You have to teach your son the right way, because not only one of your son will bear, he'll have a wife and a daughter that he'll have to protect. You know. It starts in the family. You have to teach your son the right way, you know. And a lot of our young men, and I say this today, is that a lot of our young men are practicing traditions. They're practicing ceremony, and they're starting to see, and they're starting to understand. Because when I go to ceremonies, I see these young men assisting the young ladies, assisting the women, assisting the elders. They're being taught now. They're being taught the right way on how to handle it. And that's where it starts. It starts in your home. As a parent, you teach your young man how to behave and how to be a respectful young man towards women, because women are our strength. We get our strength from women. Mother Earth, she's a woman. We get our strength from her. That's how we have to look at it, you know? Treat your wife or your mother or your sister with respect, and watch out for them and protect them, because that's our job and that's our duty, is to protect them.
And I think it's very important to acknowledge that this is a taught thing. This is these are learned behaviors, and that's why our first week in the campaign we dealt with the topic of male privilege, because unfortunately, I mean, just the way things are, this has been a very patriarchal society, and women have not been treated with respect for an enormous amount of time, and these lessons have been passed on for generations. And when you see, like, for instance, the Access Hollywood video of Donald Trump and his contempt for women, basically saying because he is a well-known celebrity, he can do this to women. Well, there are a lot of men who feel that they can do this because they are just men.
And just to clarify, as we did last week, you know, we're not bashing men or any particular man.
No.
We're talking about the way that people have been acculturated and trying to address those issues. You know, I love you. You're my husband. I have a dad who I love. I have two boys who I love, and lots of other men in my life who I love and respect. But, you know, we've all had these discussions. We've all talked about this.
Well, we're all humans, and it all comes back to, you know, the education of the family. You know, we as parents have a duty to pass on good culture, to pass on good behavior. As I said, this is taught. And the respect. Absolutely. I mean, respect for women, respect for all peoples. Respect for the earth. There is, I mean, when you kind of look, if you kind of step back from this whole thing, this conversation over the past few weeks has been pretty much about a lack of respect in so many different ways. It's unfortunate.
There is, I mean, I agree. There is no respect for humanity. You know, everybody, there is no respect like there used to be. You know, when I was growing up, when an elder walks into your room, you open the door for him, you give him your seat, you give him that respect. It's not happening today because it's not being taught. You know, but I would say my generation, we have to change that. We have to teach our younger generation what we were taught. And that comes from, you know, my age range. And, you know, I'm teaching my son how to be a young man, and he's doing it. You know, and he has a lot of good mentors that are teaching him as well. You know, like I said earlier in the broadcast, that when we did our ceremony, I was grateful that Chris was there to help teach my son some of the ways that some stuff I didn't know. You know, and that changed when we were that 10-day ceremony. And it takes a lot of men to maybe raise one man, but it's got to happen.
Absolutely. And I'll take this pause in this conversation as an opportunity to take a pause in the broadcast, let our sponsors say a few words. And again, I want to remind you that this is an open community dialogue, and time is rapidly running out. 786-KHUM, that's 786-5486. That is the number where you can call in, ask a question, make a comment. You don't have to give your name if you don't want, but this would be a good time to call right now. All right, 16 minutes after 9, you've got it on KHUM. Our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues today. A two-hour panel discussion dealing with Indigenous rights and cultural appropriation. And Amy, when we were off air, you mentioned something. I'd like to bring this up, the dialogue here in this conversation.
So several years ago, we KHUM broadcast live the repatriation of the sacred site to the Wiat people. And we know that you've been working hard to stitch back together culture that was taken from you. We want to know, like, how's that going and what's happening with the sacred site and what's next?
Is, you know, everything is moving in a slow process. We are still, you know, working on our ceremonies, and we're still working on teaching our youth the ceremonies, but it takes time. It's a slow process. And we are in the process of, you know, we have a couple things going on, working on trying to retrieve the rest of the island back. And, you know, the Sea of Rica is working well with us, and you know, it's a slow process, but hopefully we'll get there soon. And, you know, other items that we're working on is that, you know, we're also, and I hate to say it this way, but we're also fighting with Berkeley to bring back sacred items home. You know, we had a traditional headdress that was brought to the ceremony that we did in 2014. Yet Berkeley says that we can, they brought it out for us to use. But when we get ready to do ceremony, they said we can't use it. So then when we went to go repatriate it, Berkeley doesn't want to get it back because it never got used. So, you know, we're having those battles still where people, we know this artifact came from where it came from. And that right now is our main focus, is trying to get that artifact back.
That Berkeley is a huge, huge issue for Native peoples all across this country and across the world, is the repatriation of your own items, your sacred items and artifacts and remains.
It is. And to have a school tell us that we can't have it back, you know, that's pretty hurtful, and especially when it's coming from one of our own schools here in California, or universities here. And I always say something, and that is, if it came from us, it'll come back to us. So they're only holding it for right now, but it'll come home, you know. And I have that belief where wherever it came from, it goes back to where it comes from.
And they need to ask themselves, well, why are they holding it? I mean, it's kind of an odd thing, you know, at this point. It's like they want to show this as...
it's a trophy.
A trophy.
It's a trophy. It's basically what it is. It's a trophy, you know, and we go back to that, that colonialism, that racism, you know, it's a trophy. They have something that they can say we have, and they're not giving it back because it's their trophy saying, look what we got, you know, this is what we got. And we know it belongs to you, but you're not getting it back. It's like that little child said, well, now here you go, no, you can't have it back. And, you know, it's sad because what they're holding on to is something that's sacred and spiritual. You know, I always taught my grandmother that if you mess with it, something bad's going to happen, you know. So they don't know what they're messing with. They don't know what they're doing, but it'll come home.
Yeah. It's a very strange thing. I mean, you think about the fact that obviously, if you were to have a museum, say, if you were showing items of an ancient and past civilization, that is one thing. But when you are holding items from an active civilization that is around today,
without their permission.
Without their permission,
Berkeley has
it's stealing.
They have quite a bit. They have over 2,000 remains in their system, and most of it came from this area. And you would figure it'd be right for them to bring it back home, mm-hmm. so our ancestors can rest and go on to their journey. You know, our ancestors are not rested. They were disturbed, so they are not at rest right now. You know. These systems need to realize that they need to come home and they need to be put back to where they belong so they can go on their journey and finish their journey. But then, you know, it's that trophy issue. It's, we have something that you can't have back. And it's sad because they went out and they, you know, had independent archaeologists dig things up and sell it to them when, you know, how would you like us to go and dig something up and sell it back to a Native American museum and say, you can't have it back. And it doesn't work that way. It's all about, you know, the Native American is something that we don't talk about. We don't want to talk about because, like I said earlier in the program, we're this great country that protected and defended the weak. But yet we demolished the Native American community.
And if, as a listener, you were outraged by, there's been a lot lately in the news, it has been for many years, of Nazi Germany basically taking a lot of artifacts from many Jewish households and taking paintings and statuary and all kinds of stuff. And that is
art pieces and other assets.
Right. And there's a lot of outrage about that, you know, people trying to get their families get this back. You know, if you're outraged by that, you should be outraged by this. This is the same thing. This is
on a grander scale.
This is an active living culture, not one of the past, that should have their artifacts back.
Yeah, it's the same thing as we have been talking about. It's the disregard for indigenous peoples. It's the mentality of Western society and the blatant disregard to a living, surviving people. It's not necessarily the same as Nazi Germany. You know, it's the same as we've been talking about, the blatant racism that exists in the American public that continues today.
And it looks like we've got someone who wants to join into the conversation. If you can put your headphones on, we'll put them in. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, guys.
You bet.
Don't want to change the subject too much, but kind of just on the scale of local racism and kind of negative attitude towards our local people. I worked for the Hoopa tribe for 2 years. I'm not a tribal member, but I spend almost every day out there. And, you know, I know the community pretty well. But I've been bothered consistently for the last 2 years by all kind of just this negative reputation that Hoopa has. You know, our culture, including the Lost Coast Outpost, a lot just, you know, the first headline you see is Hoopa man involved in stabbing or whatever, you know, and the attitude and our culture. When people locally, liberal, hippie people hear that I work in Hoopa, they're like, oh man, you work out there? That's so scary. And I just feel like there's a lot of focus on the negative when there's also so much good stuff going on in Hoopa that never gets talked about, like the forestry practices. I work for the forestry department, are some of the most progressive in the world, and some of the ceremonies that are going on out there are just really beautiful things, and there's lots of parts of the culture that are super progressive, and the wildlife work out there is some of the most progressive in the field of research, like fishers, that's what I work for, I'm a fisher biologist studying mountain lions, and we're really pioneering some research out there, and it's because of this like great, caring tribal community that I feel like gets such a negative rap overall throughout Northern California. And I just wonder if there's a way we could maybe, as a community, change the tone here and start, you know, focusing on the positive aspects that Hoopa brings to the NorCal community.
Well said. And
yes,
yesterday I had Ryan Jackson, Hoopa Travel Chair, on. He mentioned that as well, that you know, there is a lot of negative, stereotypical rap that is put out there, but there's so much good that is going on in Hoopa. Thank you for your call.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Bye. Any of you want to comment?
Well, you know, I think in terms of commercial media, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, is the underlying assumption, unfortunately, and that's what American public likes to hear. You know, news is geared around the negative and not the positive. There's a significant amount of positive things happening in Hoopa, happening in Wiat country, happening all of the native communities around. But what's being reported is just the negative stuff. And it gets back to the concept of what does the audience want to hear? You know, to hear that there are some positive things going to save the world is something that probably is not going to lead. You know, they don't want to understand that. They don't want to believe that, that indigenous peoples have, in our understanding and in our traditional native knowledge, some keys to changing the world. And in moving beyond the paradigm of this conquest and domination mentality, they don't want to hear it.
It looks like we have another caller. So again, put the headphones back on there. We'll give you a chance to get that on there. Okay. All right. Haley, you're on the air. Who's this? Hello. Hello.
I think it's me. This is Jasmine Bucknavich in Arcata. And I just tuned in, but I just feel like I learned so much from co-cultures in this country and other countries, and kind of where we're crunched into in this moment. I would love to. I've been on my Facebook, and I see people already trying to do Michelle Obama for the next president in 2020. And as much as I would fully endorse that, I want to go back to Winona LaDuke and try and get the whole world behind something that we can lead with. And I don't want to see anything else but that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for calling. Okay. Did you have any comment?
No? Not really, no.
Well, it sounds like, you know, the person is looking for a change. You know, certainly there needs to be some major change of thinking in the world. You know, I don't know if it's going to come from Michelle Obama or Winona LaDuke. You know, I don't know if it's going to happen there. You know, but there has to be some progressive thinking to make a change. And a lot of forward-thinking people understand that we are in a state of transition, a turning point, if you will, where there is a change from what they refer to as a very mechanistic system, a culture that machines can solve our problems, to an ecological concept that we have to grow our own foods, take care of our own selves. You know, and that change is happening, and some say it's already beginning to happen at a slow pace, but it gets back to, you know, where does the change lead to? You know, and with the Wiats and other societies, you know, we look at we're addicted to ceremony, if you will, but every community needs to have a ceremony. And we look at ceremony as being the belly button, that where life comes from. You know, that's where we connect to the earth. And to be able to establish a belly button within Ferndale that is beyond Abrahamic theology, but rooted in what is alive and living here in Ferndale, needs to happen. And that will help with the turning point, the changing of a paradigm, the social transformation that is so desperately needed.
And one thing that, I guess one of my biggest disappointments, you know, having grown up in the 60s, is that, you know, my generation was, at least when I was younger, was very much into, respect for the earth, respect for people. And it seems to have, my generation seems to have forgotten that. It's very, very disappointing. I'm part of the baby boomer generation, and there are, you know, very few of us left that still actually feel that way. And it's disappointing. I have hope for the future that, you know, the current younger generation does seem to be embracing more of that. Hopefully they will continue to hold on to that as time goes on and we can evolve as a nation. I think this last election, many people are saying it's sort of like, as demographics in this country change and it becomes less and less of a white-dominated society, that things will change. And this may be, I guess, the last, if you will, great hope of the white racist society. I hope, anyway, that this is the last time that we will see this. It's almost a last gasp, if you will, and it has definitely reared its head.
Its ugly head.
Its ugly head.
And we can hope it is the last gasp, you know, of the racist society.
I have hope.
But as resources dwindle, you know, as the supply for oil dwindles, even liberal Americans will be prompted to say, drill, baby, drill. You know, and it's how to hold on to a lifestyle, the white picket fence and the two-car garage and all of this American dream. You know, in terms of looking at it from an ecological point of view,
it's sustainable.
It's a damn nightmare. You know, it's a nightmare. And that needs to change. You know, otherwise, there's people will be coming out of the woodwork saying, "Hey, let's continue it. How do we hang on to it?" Yeah. Even liberal hippies, you know, are definitely going to be saying, "Hey, we can't change. I can't go through the change. I need to hang on to this lifestyle."
Well, as I said before, you know, I grew up in the liberal hippie generation, and so many of my peers went that route that you were just mentioning. They were like, wait a minute, I want this.
You know, one of the favorite questions that one of our professors used to ask me in graduate school, ask our whole class all the time, was, and how does this look in a post-petroleum economy? Yeah. How does your project look when we don't have this anymore? And trying to, as a landscape architect, trying to design for a future that's different was a really interesting challenge. And it's a question that always now hovers in the back of my mind is, and how does this look in a post-petroleum economy?
And the reality is we were supposed to have run out of petroleum by now, maybe like 30 years ago. But they keep coming up with new ways of finding more and extracting more. And these methodologies are so destructive. I mean, you see what's going on right now with fracking to get more natural gas. It's amazing, and there is such denial of the destruction that is being wrought on this planet for these kinds of extractive technologies. They're horrific, and there's just such denial that this is going on. And really, there does need to be a change. There has to be a shift. I mean, at some point, we will really run out of everything, but we just seem to keep squeezing this this sponge more and more and more and more until it's going to be dry.
Yeah. And, you know, the sad part is you're right. You know, we're going to run out. And people are going to be lost. They're going to, like, they ain't going to know how to actually survive. But, and I don't want to say this the wrong way, but the indigenous community will survive because we know what we're doing and how to do it. And we know how to take care of our families. We know how to take care of our elders. We know how to take care of that. But the funny part is that when this happens, everybody's going to be running to all indigenous companies around the world and saying, help us. And we're going to say, you know, we tried helping, but you guys didn't want to listen. You guys wanted to take what wasn't yours. And that's going to be the sad situation. We're going to run out of the resources. And I hate to say it that way. We are. But we as an indigenous community will know how to take care of our families and take care of ourselves when this happens because we will survive. We're survivalists. That's how we survive is we teach each other.
As Amy mentioned, you know, 98% of all scientists feel that this is an unsustainable path that we are on. It is destructive and cannot be sustained. Yet, we march forward towards our destruction.
Stop the violence, you know, stop the violence on Earth. I mean, that's mm-hmm. where, you know, everybody should be saying. Instructional programs in school should be designed around how to sustain the earth rather than how to extract from the earth, you know. And right now you go into any school, any public school in America, it's how to continue a paradigm that is dying. You know, there is no conscious effort to say, hey, we have to institute a curriculum to heal the earth. You know, and that's where it needs to, at the level it needs to happen is every school system in America needs to revise curriculum around that concept of sustaining and preserving the Earth's ecosystems.
And this denial now moves into high gear Donald Trump gets ready to take office. He has already pledged to pull us out of our agreements with the last climate change summit. He has vowed to
scrap the EPA.
Scrap the EPA to bring coal production to full tilt. It's could be environmental disaster.
Yeah. America was never great. You know, and I think that at least in under Western society's administration of the earth, America prior to conquest and discovery was great. You know, but in terms of the concept of a great America being productive and everybody having a job, the consequences is what is the impact on the environment? You know, to restart those concepts, those coal companies, those oil drillings, and all of that has greater impact and moves us quicker to destruction.
On that note, we are going to take this opportunity to take a quick break and get into our final segment of our two-hour panel discussion. The topic is indigenous rights and cultural appropriation, and if you would like to join the conversation again, the number is 786-KHUM. That's 786-5486. Okay, we're about 20 minutes ahead of 10 o'clock. We're down to our last segment of this panel discussion dealing with indigenous rights and cultural appropriation. I think it's time we went around the room and introduced ourselves again, just so folks know who you're listening to. I'm Cliff Berkowitz, obviously.
Amy Berkowitz. In addition to co-hosting here, mm-hmm. I think I'll put out a couple of qualifications. I'm mm-hmm. a licensed landscape architect with a specialty in ecosystematic design. I also teach for College of the Redwoods.
I'm Chris Peters.
Seventh Generation Fund.
Seventh Generation Fund.
President.
Tanner Nass. I'm with the Wiat Tribe.
There we go. Okay, and we were spending the last few moments talking about extractive technologies and the cost that it's been having on the world.
And I really want to emphasize what Ted was talking about, because if we know that what we're doing now doesn't work, and we know that it leads to destruction, and we know that it's finite, and we know that it could potentially irreparably damage the potential for life on Earth, then we do need a radical change. And changing the curriculum, like, why would we set up our children to do the same things we're doing now when we know they don't work? I like that thought a lot.
Absolutely. And the mistaken thought that some people feel with this extractive technologies that we've been doing and upping the ante so much is that, you know, the Earth is resilient. And the Earth is resilient. But to a degree, there is a certain point where you can't sustain this any longer.
We know that the Earth has a pulse. We know that the Earth has a respiration. That's global ecology mm-hmm. science. As Ted said, and she also has a temper.
That's right. I mean, and there's, right now, there's some thought in the scientific community that we may have already gone past the tipping point. Some say we were very close to it. Either way, we can't continue on this path. As I was saying off air, this is like a mutual suicide pact. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, I'll take what I can now before, you know, future generations are lost. We'll take it now. It's kind of selfish. It's actually very selfish.
You know, to that point, you know, I can see our younger generation seeing this now. But I think our generation, the older generation, have destroyed it so much that it's going to be pretty hard for our younger generation to fix it.
Yeah.
But they see it, and they are trying to fix it. And I give them that. We have our young water protectors in North Dakota, in Standing Rock. They're trying to protect it. You know, it's the younger generation that is going to be fixing it, but it's going to take them a while to fix it. And, you know, it's our generation that did it. It's our generation that did it because we wanted that greed. We wanted that money. We wanted the lavish lifestyle. we want to, you know, the two cars, the two-car garage, the nice satellite, the big screen TVs, you know?
Right. It's like a giant credit card. They've been racking up the payments, and they are due.
With big balloons and nasty interest.
That's right.
But I think Chris said the best, so, you know, it needs to be put, the information needs to be put back into the schools, the critical, you know, it needs to be put there. Our kids nowadays are smart because they're asking the questions. Mm-hmm. And they want the truth. They want to know the truth. They want to know how to fix it.
Absolutely. And, you know, millennials often get, you know, bashed and put down. But they're
amazing.
The future. They're amazing. Mm-hmm. They are the future. They do have their eyes open.
They do.
And
as a generation, they like to take action.
Yep. And so I'm very hopeful. And for the first time, they are outnumbering we baby boomers. I hand the baton to you as one of the few left in the baby boomers who actually believe in this stuff to make it happen, take it to the finish line.
And I think that's important, taking it to the finish line, because there needs to be optimism as well, that survival is possible.
Yep.
You know, and we look at the scientific perspectives and and to a certain amount the realities that we're confronted with. You know, we are already living on the resources. We are already heating ourselves on the fuel, and we're already eating the food for our grandkids and generations to come. We're consuming now and paying it forward, but there has to be some level of optimism. And beginning to change will provide an optimism for younger generations to pursue more aggressively. But I think it's up to us in this generation to look and conceive and to dream and to visualize a route to survival, you know, and or a route to to survival. Because sometimes we look at every effort at mitigating the system is too late. You know, how can we survive the impact is the optimism. How can we preserve a human race that survives an impact of a calamity?
Yeah, well said, Chris. I think that you make a very, very valid point. I mean, we can talk doom and gloom, but it's what can we do about it? We are only going to do something about it if there is hope. And I tend to be an optimistic person. I do think that there is hope. I think we can turn things around. It's a long journey. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've done an enormous amount of damage. But I do remain optimist that there can be change. We can make a difference. Just keep my fingers crossed that
the
rest believe it.
I have to agree. I do have hope, and I see it in our young kids, you know. It's not just the indigenous kids, it's all the children.
Mm-hmm.
I see it. They want change. They don't want to follow in the footsteps of what's ahead of them, you know. They want change. You see these kids, you know, especially in, like, we're going back to Stop the Violence. You see these kids standing up to adults saying, why? Why did you do this? And this is coming from a 13-year-old to a 50-year-old, you know, these kids want this. They want to see the change, and they're not going to follow those footsteps because they see what's right and they see what's wrong, and they're not going to stand for it no more.
Absolutely, and I've been criticized by younger people saying your generation has, you know, look what you've done to this planet, and you know the natural reaction is to be defensive, but I own it. I said you're right. You know, our generation fell way short of what we were hoping to do, and
screwed things up pretty good.
Screwed up pretty good.
We
blew it. We blew it big time, and on a larger scale than anyone thought possible.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, you can take this ball and run with it, as I said, and take it across the finish line, because we made some big mistakes.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. Wow. Well, we are rapidly running out of time, as incredible as that may seem. So I think what I want to do is take a moment for all of us, I guess, to give some final closing thoughts on this conversation, something you want to leave our listeners with, something for them to think about and chew on. So, I guess, Ted, I guess I'll start with you.
Well, I think we could chew on is that there is hope still. There is hope. You know, our younger generation is going to be able to take care of it, but it's going to take a while to fix. And I have hope in our younger generation. Do I have hope in my generation? No, because we're stubborn. We don't want to listen. But the younger generation, I do have hope in. You know, as the caller said back, they're doing a lot of great work in Hoopa. They're doing a lot of great work in your country. We're doing a lot of great work here in Wiat country, you know. We all have our purpose. And the hope is it's this younger generation that's going to carry it. And they're going to take it, and they're going to go all the way with it. But I do want to give one more shout-out, you know, then that's to, you know, today's Veterans Day. I want to make sure that we recognize all of our veterans that served, you know, Native Americans especially. You know, we had a big part in these wars, and, you know, I want to recognize all of our veterans, not just Native Americans, but all of our veterans, because that's what it's built on, is that we have to recognize our warriors, the ones that stood for freedom. The freedom that we have today to ruin what we're doing today, you know, that's a shame, but they stood for something that was for our freedom.
Chris?
Yeah, you know, I think Stop the Violence is a campaign that needs to flourish in the United States and in the world. You know, how do we stop violence? You know, certainly violence against indigenous peoples is of major concern. You know, and I think a lot of the conversation we had earlier kind of talks to that issue, the dehumanization of indigenous peoples and the dehumanization of the indigenous women has been so blatant within American society, and that has to change. You know, that we have to look at a different world that has a different concept of human beings and people. But looking beyond that, you know, violence, stopping the violence against Mother Earth is of equal significance or greater significance than any human involved. You know, long beyond human extinction, the Earth has to continue to survive. And, you know, I'm maybe less optimistic of human survival in the long run, but certainly the Earth has to survive. And to be able to do that, we have to stop the violence. Humans have to stop the violence. Within the past 5,000 years, human population has evolved to the point of the most destructive creature that the Earth has ever experienced. You know, and the potential for it to even grow bigger is so pervasive in society. Let's see how many bombs we can build and how many nuclear plants we can start. All of that stuff is a threat to the life cycle of the Earth's ecosystem, and I think we have to make a conscious change. Humans have to sit back and make a conscious, intellectually based change to for a new world. And how do we do that? You know, I think that's an issue that is so upon us now with the current election. You know, the optimism that I see is, well, half the folks didn't vote for him, you know. And even more optimism, they're in the streets, you know, saying, hey, we have to change. We have to find out some mechanism change. And it's not, hopefully not necessarily just changing one man, because changing one man doesn't make a change. It has to change the system, has to change the philosophy behind the system and what the one man stands for in terms of its destructive path that has been taken and will continue to perpetrate on the earth. And hopefully there is that thinking within the opposition, that people in the streets, that we have to do a change.
Amy?
Wow, hard to follow. I want to start by saying that I'm incredibly grateful to be on Wiat Land. I think this is the most beautiful and wonderful place on earth. This is where we chose to be, and we're very grateful to be here, and thank you. Thank you both for coming and sharing your thoughts and your ideas. I think that what I would like to leave people with is a challenge to start visioning what that's going to look like, what that world is going to look like, where we honor our indigenous people, where we honor their commitment to caretake the earth and nurture her. What does that world look like where all people are honored and respected, where women don't have to fear for their safety, where boys and girls can grow up to their full potential as individuals representing their cultures? you know, what does that look like? What does that world look like? What does that educational system look like? What does that governing system look like? What does our food system look like? Everything. Like, what does that look like? So start thinking about it, because as we start thinking about it and start talking about it, those are the first steps to making that happen.
I agree with everything everyone's said thus far. My thought is, and I've been thinking about this this campaign this year, and it all kind of revolves around selfishness. You know, there's so much selfishness, and this is resulting in violence and destruction. And I would hope that people could become more selfless, and which then does lead to respect. And I am hopeful that the shock of what has just happened at this in this election, I am hopeful that a lot of people who have been complacent for a long time, who have been in spirit along the righteous path but have not been active on it, that this may wake people up to the fact that maybe I have to actually do something to help make this world a better place rather than just be righteous in my mind. What actions can I take to maybe make this a better world where people are more respectful of each other? That's my hope, my thought anyway. Next week, we continue this campaign. Next week, we are going to be dealing with the topic of the violence of poverty. You know, people who are poor are amongst those who are they're vulnerable. There are so many different acts of violence that that occur to those at the bottom rung of the wealth ladder. It's horrific, and it's a very, very hard thing to get out of. It's a trap where people can be locked into this for generations.
Mm-hmm. But we are bringing some resources in to talk
Absolutely.
About what folks can do. We've got people coming in from the job market. We've got people coming in from Food for People and other food pantries. Mm-hmm. And we've got Betty Chin coming back. Mm-hmm. She's always inspirational. And then we'll have our healing breakfast a week from today at the Eureka Women's Club. It's free. Everybody is welcome to attend from 8 until 10 in the morning. We'll have our panel discussion. We have community resources. Ramon's is donating pastries. Signature Coffee is going to be providing the coffee. I'll bring some tea and some other things. Anna Banana Hamilton will be playing our music. And it's a chance for us to get together as a community and provide support and hope and really look for solutions.
Absolutely. And we will be starting the entire thing. Cheryl Seidner is going to be doing a traditional We Out blessing to begin the...
And joining our panel discussion.
And joining our panel discussion as well. It's going to be quite good, and I certainly hope folks can come and be part of that. I know it's early in the morning, 8 until 10, but I think it'd be well worth it.
Yes, and we want to thank the Eureka Women's Club again this year for donating this beautiful space for us to be at. Mm-hmm. And if you can't join us in person, at least listen on the air. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got one more week of powerful community discussions, and thank you all for coming, and thank everybody for listening. It's very important, I think.
Indeed. Thank you, Amy. And thank you, Chris Peters and Ted Hernandez, for coming in and sharing with all of us today.
And thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to take our final break, and we will hand the reins over to Bailey Brown up next.